Hi there. Before we start, if you're new to our show, thank you so much for tuning into our program and we hope you'll stay with us for a very long time. And if you're a regular listener, thank you so much for your continued support throughout this period of uncertainty. We're really grateful for all your kind words and encouragement. You really help this podcast to gain a great exposure as our mission is to center the perspectives of the people who look like us and as women and people who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple and Google or Spotify. Leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support us, please head to Buy Me Coffee page to make a donation, which will help us to continue the intersectionality of the podcast industry.
Hey all, this is Jessie.
Hi, this is Helen.
And we are back with our latest episode of Asian Bitches Down Under. Back, because last week we had a little break due to me.
Yeah.
My sickness.
How are you recovering?
Yeah, I had like basically the basic flu. I still haven't had COVID.
Oh, he's still having COVID.
I think my partner
we're the rare ones who has
Oh, wait,
had
have you not had it either?
No, I haven't, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah, we three are the only... And what about your husband?
Yeah. My husband
and I had it,
I was isolating with them, but I guess maybe just constantly wearing a mask and, you know, cleaning all the time.
Well,
kept me away from it.
Yeah, your OCD-ness probably. Yeah. OCD. I don't know. But like when my part like last a few weekends ago I threw a birthday party surprise party for my partner and then when we hung out with their friends there was this other couple who also didn't have children and she said oh yeah we're like the only people who don't have COVID because you know we don't have kids
but
you have kids and you still have
not lucky COVID, enough you know, I guess
so, yeah, yeah it's not a but anyway I basically. Had just a basic cold and it took me about 8 days. Even now I'm still a bit snotty. So it's, yeah, and I haven't had any kind of dramatic, severe medications. But, you know, I feel like, I don't know how you feel, Helen, but the older I get, it certainly takes my body much, much longer to get better.
Yeah, I feel the same as well. I think that's why I'm trying my best and not to catch anything. Now, you know, when there's a vaccine came out and I just quickly go and get it because I just can't afford to feel shit, you know, trying to keep up
it's...
on top of everything as well, work and house and family and just, the society just demands more of a woman, you know.
Do you know what I was thinking? I know. I was thinking because like we had our Women's Agenda Leadership Awards last week as well.
Uh-huh.
And this is how I generally feel about dressing up. From a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of excitement, it's like -5. However, like when it comes to, I guess, an event like for my organization and who I absolutely like enjoy working for and I love the people I work for, like I was a bit perked up for it. Like, and the night before I was like trying out different outfits
because
I was
nice.
Like, ooh, I want to wear this suit or whatever. But anyway, on the day, I ended up just wearing the most basic stuff I wear all the time. Like, the most basic kind of piece that any kind of normal... Like, I was probably even underdressed in terms of what you'd see if you walk down...
To an
the
awards
streets of
ceremony.
The CBD. Yeah. Like, I think that day, because our awards was in the city, I had to do the agonizing task of walking through Sydney CBD, which I just absolutely abhor because I hate the city. Because, you know, listeners would know I hate suits. I hate people who wear suits and I don't like just corporate culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, like, seriously, every single woman I pass is, like, in high heels. Their hair looked like it just had been blown dry professionally. the nails are properly done.
Uh-huh.
They're, like, immaculately. They all have fake eyelashes. They have immaculate makeup. It's just like, oh, it just exhausts me. So, anyway, I was, like, very underdressed compared to even these women who do this, you know, dress up
every day.
Yeah, but I was thinking... Because, like, the reason why I kind of decided not to put on any makeup because for the awards was because, you know, I was, like, blowing my nose heavily because I still kind of had a cold.
You would just smudge your makeup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I was like, how do people in Hollywood do it? You know, like, how do people in Hollywood, like, if they have a cold, how do they just, like, Do they just, like, have some sort of special medicine?
I just feel like they take tons of medicine to keep their face to a standard requirement for the cameras, I guess.
Right, yeah. Because, like, I really couldn't stop the, like, my nose was just, like, I needed to blow it every half
and you hour. Still went. Oh, my goodness.
I know. I should have been arrested, shouldn't I? I know. I kind of thought I shouldn't go because, like, it's now completely uncouth to go rock up at work.
With
any kind of symptoms at all. But, like, because we have such a small team, I felt like, for one, I really just wanted to go. I really wanted to be there. And secondly, I felt bad if I did go. And, like, it's a once in a year thing. Like, these awards things are very, it's a big event in our calendar. Anyway, I'm talking too much about my day job. On this podcast, I'd rather talk about just, you know, my life outside of that. But, it got me thinking, like, you know, how Hollywood people do it, you know. But I think you're right. They probably just like female athletes, they take the pill so they don't have periods during their competition days, right?
Yeah, but also they are often, like, celebrities and athletes, they will be, like, the type of people that are really disciplined and probably very isolated. I'm assuming some people who are very disciplined and maybe very isolated from
very good point.
The rest of the society, so they're less likely to catch anything, I'm guessing.
Colds, yeah.
You're getting sick.
That is,
or they'll
so
be
true.
Looked after by this top tier of doctors that monitor their health all the time or something like that.
Yeah, and they treat their bodies like machines, basically.
Yeah.
Because they have to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Excellent viewpoint, Helen. How was your week?
My week's been good. So last week, I had an opportunity to go to the theatre play that I had the pleasure of interviewing the director and the writer. And we were going to go together.
Yes, but because I ditched Helen because I was sick. Sorry, Helen.
So I had my friend, she went with me on the night. So it was called Chain Play, presented by Slanted Theatre, which is led by the amazing artistic director Tiffany Wan, with two brand new short plays produced for the Sydney Fringe Festival. So the first, it was two plays within an hour, and the first play was called Where There Is a Wheel, There's a Way. It's a rather humorous take on the wheel, you know, like a written wheel left by this for an aged care worker from an old Asian lady. It's almost like a very complicated outlook into people's perception about Bitcoin, NFT, greed and family dynamics, you know, all those things. Like, when people start to talk about Bitcoin, I actually, like, my mind is turned off.
Oh, totally.
So I couldn't really
mention about any mention about Bitcoin. I literally just, like, my mind. You know that meme where Homer Simpson, like, he's having a conversation with Ned Flanders, and Ned is talking to him about cider. How do you tell
the difference between apple cider and apple?
Yeah, and then his brain just leaves his brain. His brain just leaves his skull. That is literally what happens to.
There's a monkey playing the toy.
Oh yeah, the monkey. Yeah. My brain literally leaves my skull whenever anyone talks about Bitcoin or anything to do with, like, NFTs.
Yeah, so that first play, I didn't really feel resonate of it, but it's like the performance was good. However, the second one, which is called How Asian Are You, I like this one better. It really explores the idea of what is defined as Asian in the Western world and who is the gatekeeper who decides what entails as Asianness and to what degree we decide or we consider as exoticization of a race. Like, I think that the second play was a bit more, it's funnier, I think. At the same time, it explores a lot of social complexities for Asian diasporas in the Western countries.
Oh, cool. I think I would have liked that.
Yeah, you would. It's set on the. It depicts a story of. It starts with a girl talking to a counselor about her worries of a relationship because an Asian girl is like saying that, oh, my boy, this guy that I met at a club or somewhere, he was into me. Like, he specifically picked me out of all my friends, but I'm not a good looking person. Like, I'm not. The differences between me and all my other friends is that I'm Asian. And this boy, he's like a mix. So I'm not quite sure whether or not that he's fetishization of an Asian woman, or because does he like me because of me, or does he like me because I'm an Asian?
Yeah, so I mean, that is literally this question that has gone through every single Asian woman's mind in Australia or anywhere in the East, in the West, right?
Yes, yeah.
At least for those people who date white people, I guess. You never really know.
Mm, I'm feeling really excited about the perspectives of the Asian creators in the fields of, like, performing arts and
theatre. I agree. Yeah. I agree. And I think it's ones like Slander Theatre that are really going to shift the culture in a very dramatic and effective way. Because, honestly, I don't think, like, if you enter
Sydney theatre company,
yeah, STC or anything like that, I think you're in a way just pandering to the white people. You're just like telling stories that make them feel good, or like you're educating them, or it's like it's really not for Asian people.
Mm-hmm. You know, but you're not really telling the real story, I think.
Yeah, you're telling the sanitized, whitewashed version of Asian stories, or what white people would find palatable about, you know, an Asian voice.
That's very true. Yeah. So I have my friend Shin with me on a night, and that was actually her first experience of going to indie theatre production, and a production by Asian Australians. And she said it was beyond her expectation. She initially thought that it was going to be like a school sort of performance, but it was really good for her. She said that it was, they're all done very expressive performance. I don't know how to explain it in English. Like all the actors were 很用力. Like they're really putting in their mind into it to perform their characters. Yeah, it was really good. Yeah, so how about you? What have you been watching, reading
this
week?
Well, last night, we went to a media screening of a new horror film. And you know how I usually feel about horror. I'm not a fan.
Before you gonna start, when you call me, I was going to put my face so close onto the screen and give you like a huge smile, because I saw on the notes that you were going to about to talk about this film.
Tell us about it. That's a good thing you didn't, because I'll tell you what, last night after we came home, I did that to my partner, and then he did it back to me, and I fucking freaked out, man. After you watch Smile and then you do that kind of particular smile to your friends and family.
Oh my gosh, so creepy.
It's so freaky. It's very uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, Smile is a movie, and the protagonist is the daughter of Kevin Bacon and Kira Sedgwick. Is that how you say her name?
Oh, you didn't in the real life?
Yeah. She's I didn't even know.
Kevin Bacon's...
Okay. I was like, Kevin Bacon's daughter. Awesome. Yeah, so I think her name is Boise Bacon, and she's a great actor. Mm-hmm. And Caitlin Stacey is also in this movie. She's the one whose face is on the movie posters you'll see around Sydney and around Australia. It's basically kind of like The Ring, but instead of watching the video, it's like the curse is passed on by someone who smiles at you in that very
uncanny way.
Did you watch the trailer? Yeah, the trailer is horrifyingly
scary. Fucking scary.
And can I just say, because I saw the trailer, I knew when to not look at the screen. And you know, I was in a media screening with like hundreds of people, and so like it's very embarrassing if you're covering your eyes. As does what Jessie Too normally does when she watches a horror film. So I'll just put my face near the screen so Helen can see. This is what I was doing the whole night.
Closing your eyes.
Yeah, I was just closing my eyes and listening to the sound, because I just cannot bear horror, because I have a very lucid imagination, and like even last night when I went to bed, I just imagined, when I got up to go pee during the night, I imagined just like
this smiling face right next to you,
like Caitlin Stacey, like smiling at me in the kitchen. So basically, it's like you're cursed if someone smiles at you, and then you end up killing yourself, basically. It's honestly the same
rhetoric as The Ring. You know,
that's like, so many different things, Helen. There's the horror trope is just everywhere. Yeah, it makes you kill yourself, right? Like, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had like a lot of horror films that like are based around the perceptive senses that we have. Like Sandra Bullock starred in one, I think it was called
Bird Cage or something like that.
Blackbird, I think it was it?
Where
you have to blind yourself, blindfold, because if you see it, you'll kill yourself. Other stuff like that.
I wonder if it's trying to reflect on certain things that's happening around human society. But it's also very, I can't find the words for it. Every time that it this kind of feeling gets to me, I couldn't find a word in English or even in Chinese for it. It feels like it's on reflecting on how we see mental health as well. As in, when you said the film is about the horror is that the person eventually kills themselves.
Yeah.
Like, it's also, I don't know whether or not it's reflecting on the ideas about suicide or...
I think so. It does touch a lot about on the aspects of mental illness and PTSD and trauma and schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Psychosis.
The film.
Because, like, the protagonist, she is... her name is Rose, and she's a therapist, psychiatrist, who kind of works at a hospital and manages kind of psychotic patients... or patients who are psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
And what I haven't actually said to you, Helen, or the listeners, is that the people who do end up killing themselves, they have all suffered some sort of trauma in their past lives.
Mm.
And so, like, this is a little bit of a small spoiler, but you find out very early in the movie that her mother actually had committed suicide when she was a little girl. And she kind of has always blamed herself. And so, like, I think this movie is kind of trying to say, like, trying to be some allegory to, like, trauma or, like, unresolved pain.
Mm-hmm.
Some allegory about, I guess that. There was a lot of jump scares, which was like, I knew when it was coming, so I just had my eyes closed.
Mm.
Later, Andrew was asking me, how did I know they were coming if I have never seen it? I was like, oh, it's very obvious because...
Yeah.
No, I saw the trailer, so I knew when the scary bits would... But also, the music is very indicative of when something... Oh, my
goodness. Yeah, they have to be, like,
horror movies. Whenever a jump scare is about to happen, the music dies down, like, completely. Into silence,
yeah,
and then
fades
and then
away
something,
into silence. Yeah, yeah,
and then something horrible comes up on the screen. So I literally had my eyes either closed the whole night or like squinted enough that my vision was just blurry, so I didn't see anything in focus.
But would you feel the reactions of the other audiences?
Oh yeah, yeah. I just listened to everyone. Like, yeah, exactly. It was very funny listening to the other audience members gasp. Yeah.
I don't think I can go through that kind of movie.
I hate horror films, yeah, but I mean, that was fun. That was fun, yeah.
But I wonder how people with, you know, mental health, like traumas, PTSD, see...
How they register films like this. Yeah, I know. I'm curious
response
as well.
To this kind of movie. You know, you're almost making like some other people's tragedy into an entertainment.
That is literally what the whole world is based on, Helen. Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
that's a good point, and I also watched Uma. Uma, which is the Korean
word
term
for mother,
mum, and it's starring Sandra Oh. It's from a couple of years ago now, and that's also kind of like a psychological horror film.
I thought it was like a very recent film.
Oh, maybe it was released last year.
Yeah, I think it's 2021.
But anyway, yeah, it didn't get a lot of fanfare, and after you watch it, you realize why. It's not a splendid film, I have to say.
Uh-huh.
A lot of things are not resolved. The writing is not very strong. I mean, it's still watchable. It's definitely watchable. Mother-daughter relationship.
Sandra Oh.
Yeah, it's like a story of Sandra Oh and her daughter. She's a single mother raising her daughter in like the outskirts of who knows where, and they're like beekeepers. And then one day, Sandra Oh's like uncle comes and brings her the ashes of her mother who had passed away in Korea, and she kind of has to. And then her mother haunts her, you know, in the afterlife, because she had had run away from her mum. You find out that her mum was kind of very abusive. to her. It's really good. Again, it's another trauma narrative, I have to say. Trauma and horror, I think, is like inextricably linked in Hollywood.
And for women, usually it will be for women, isn't it?
Yeah. I feel like in the genre of horror, it's the only way in which like the public can come to terms with like the actual reality of what it means to be a woman in this world, you know? It is like really hard. Yeah. It's you like obviously it's a movie. It's heightened. Yeah, but like it's like the only way in which the world can comprehend stories about women is often through like horror narratives.
Because that's the reality of women's life, horror.
Yeah. And like it's the only way that people can it's the only way that people find it legible, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like this idea
that
of
they could understand
trauma and horror in a woman's life.
It reminded me a trailer that I saw a little while ago. I think it's an A24 production where you see this woman walking down like a dark tunnel from her night out or something like that, and she keeps looking back.
Uh-huh.
And you know how those kind of a montage that will suddenly have a man appear in front of her or something like that?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the scene kind of creates the fear of being a single woman at night walking by herself. At the end of the trailer, the title appears for the movie. It is called Men.
Oh, you know, it's like a really famous movie from like earlier this year. I really wanted to see it. It's with Jesse Buckley. I haven't seen it actually, but I think that's another trauma narrative.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and that trailer fucking scared the fuck out of me. That trailer is so well done.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that movie yet. There are a lot of movies I haven't seen that I was supposed to see this year, like that Elvis movie. I really wanted to see, and then now I've just like can't be bothered seeing just because I can't bear Austin Butler. He's kind of annoying to me now. And also another movie I really want to see that I probably will not end up seeing at the cinemas is Don't Worry Darling, which is Olivia Wilde's movie that I'm sure the entire planet has
so
already heard so too much about
around it.
Just annoying now. It's just it's annoyed me so much that I don't even want to see it. So let's move on to another form of art. I was going to say a better form of art, books, but no, I don't think books are better than movies. I'd say they're the same for me. I love them both equally. So this week I finished couple of books.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm in my laundry and my broom keeps falling off. I was very eager and excited to read Victoria Hanna's second book, Marshmallow.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't read the first book.
Yes, I read the first book and wasn't
How'd you find it?
It was okay. I'm not in the narratives. I don't really like to read a narrative that just talks about feelings too much. I prefer a bit more descriptives. Which is very contrary to you because you prefer... I mean, Intimacy by Katie Kitamura was really good.
The best book ever written, hands down.
But I think no other books that trying to write it like that has reached a certain similar level as Kitamura.
I have to say, I have to say I'm always startled by the difference in American writers and Australian writers. And I have to say, they're the only kind of writers I read. I mainly read, like, American writers... or Australian writers. I read
like English writers or English Asian writers.
Well, I love Deborah Levy. She's an English author. And I love Olivia Lang. There are plenty of English female writers that I love. But I can't help but just think American writers and American literature is just like superior. I know I shouldn't think that. But anyway, moving on.
Marshmallow.
Marshmallow. I mean, first of all, great title. It's just such a great title. But the story just revolves around like 5 30-somethings who are overcoming the grief of a 2-year-old kid who had died after choking on a marshmallow a year ago.
Oh.
Which is like kind of shocking, right? Uh-huh. And it's a very central trauma narrative.
Yeah.
I felt like I read this in 2 days, so like it's very, very readable. But I found bits of it like a bit tedious, just because like I was like, oh, I don't know where this is going.
Yeah, that's and like how I'm, I just feel about listening, her,
I'm just listening. I'm just reading like feeling work. After feeling. Like it was just, and the scenes didn't really go anywhere.
Move
it was just
on
like
to anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, it was just like a conversation with a friend about how they're grieving, and then like one of the characters goes on a date with a Taiwanese woman, and then we never hear about that woman again. and then one of the characters has a fight with his mum, and then like by the end of it, it's just like, oh, I don't know. It's just like it's just like 250 pages of fear, kind of feelings about grief and like it was a good book. Like I really enjoyed it, but I thought it would make a great series. Like I could actually imagine it being an Australian television series, because somehow Aussies are just fucking obsessed with trauma, honestly. Trauma narratives are everywhere. Like I can't think of any examples, just because I watch zero Australian television. But
when you mentioned like that it's an incident from like a birthday party, it reminded me of Le Slap.
Oh yeah, that's what everyone's saying. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Because because like
you have a family.
You follow like seven different people and their perspectives. Uh-huh. So I thought that's what Hannon was gonna do with her book, but she actually it's just like third person. So she narrates every person's feelings and their perspective, but she never takes a first person perspective on each character. It's just like third person narration. But like about trauma, I mean, the last Australian series I watched was Love Me, which is on Binge, which was huge, I think, when it came out a few years ago. Do you know much about it, Helen?
No, I hardly watch any Australian dramas. I watch lifestyle shows, but that's about it.
Lifestyle shows? Like what? Yeah. Better Homes and Gardens?
No, not Better Homes and Gardens. Like cooking shows on SBS and ABC.
Oh, right.
I don't really have to follow the story. I just know, watch it without using much brain cells.
Yeah. So Love Me basically is like, I think it was 6 or 7. It's a limited series. It was like 6 or 7 episodes. I think one episode was about 50 minutes or maybe up to an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it followed the story of a family who had just lost the maternal figure. So Hugo Weaving is the dad, and then he has two kids.
Uh-huh.
And the mother figure, she has like, she had an accident a few years ago, so she's like wheelchair bound, and she's in the first episode, this is not a spoiler, she dies.
Mm.
And then he ends up going to a holiday he was about to take with his wife. He goes alone and then meets a woman there, and then they fall in love, and you know, he starts having sex with her almost immediately. And then also the two kids, so like one of them is a 38-year-old anaesthetist who's like so beautiful that you just can't believe that she's single. But she's a bit neurotic, so she's a bit kind of like, I shouldn't say neurotic because I'm pathologizing her sort of inappropriate way. But anyway, she's just like really, I find her very likable. So I like her predicament of being single was a bit unbelievable. But anyway, so in the first episode or the second, she meets this hot dude who we find out like has a kid, and she's like shocked that he didn't tell her. To be honest, I was like, big deal. But and then also the son, there's a young son who's like in his early 20s who like is in love with this girlfriend who's like a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a woman of color. She's like dark skin. She's a brown woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up being like pretty awful. And I kind of came away from the series, like I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the series, and I rarely enjoy Aussie television. But like it left a sour taste in my mouth in regards to the characterization of the only woman of color in the series is like a freaking bitch.
Yeah.
She's awful. Like she's like she doesn't even care about like the way she treats this
boyfriend.
Like young boy is so like awful that I'm like, ugh, I don't know. Like
why do they have to scripted like that for this
character? Exactly. Like in the same way that often people will tell me, you know, they love the White Lotus, often it's a white person who says that. And then I always like, I'm always like, I counter it by saying, yeah, it was good television. Like, obviously it was well written, but like, I didn't like that the only person of color, not the only person of color, the only male man of color,
mm-hmm.
who is like one of the service people at the resort, he ends up being like a criminal.
Mm.
Like he steals something from one of the people, the white people's rooms. And like, I don't know, it's just like, I feel very uncomfortable when these shows include a person of color, but then the way that they write these mm-hmm. people of color mm-hmm. is like in such an insidious way.
Yeah,
it's just so yeah. insidious, and it doesn't
sit right with me either.
Yeah, it doesn't sit right with me, and you know, I just every time I see this, I'm just like, obviously, a team of white people wrote this. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
it didn't make me.
They
happy
have to
that
give the villain character to a person
to a
color.
Person of color. Yeah, yeah, it's like, what the hell? I don't get it. I really don't get it. Like, what is it with white people that they just really have to?
They can't bear the fact that they can write a white villain character. They have to, they're thinking that, oh yeah, we're gonna have a person of color in our production, but we're gonna give them a terrible character.
Yeah, I mean, don't they know that people watch this and like, and don't they know that stories are what build our beliefs? You know what yeah. I mean? Like, that's where stereotypes come from. God.
It's written for an white audience again.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's what I always say, that movies and dramas, you kind of perpetuate a certain narratives that the writer is trying to present for people to perceive, but in the very subtle ways that most people wouldn't think about it. Like, for example, what we just picked up, you know, the people of color being cast as a villain character. I feel like it's always been like that, or being cast as a funny side character, it became a kind of like a stereotype for a lot of people of color to be involved in the certain production, but they are typical characters for them to portray, as in they will never get the lead characters because it's usually a white person to take yeah. on that role. Yeah. And it's usually, it won't be a heroic character again. You know, it's usually yeah. will be a very marginalized, peripheral
yeah, character. Basically, we're just never humanized. And like,
yeah.
I kind of, when you think about the metrics of Hollywood, it makes sense because most of the people who go to these films, well, like the Hollywood studios, they're made up of white people who are serving white people who are only thinking yes. about the white audience. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they're going to put a white lead because it needs to be quote unquote relatable,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Never thinking that, you know, never thinking that we have to ever, like, as in, you know, people of color, we know that we have never had the luxury of this thing called like only relating to people who look like you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the first person I saw who looked like me on TV was Lucy Liu in Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, but then even with that character, now think of it, like, years, decades, it's like decades 20 later. Years, yeah, yeah, 20 years later, it's a character that's been highly sexualized.
Totally.
It paints over a certain traits as an Asian woman for everyone to see in, you know, in the Western countries, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I just mean, like, we are, it's assumed that we will relate to people who don't look like us, whereas, like, for white people, they have never been asked to relate to a black gay person, you know, for instance.
Yeah.
That's not asked of them. It's like, yeah, just their imagination has not been forced to stretch that far compared to, you know, people who look like us. Any other things? What about you, Helen, the books you're reading?
Oh, before I go on to the books that I'm reading, I want to mention a great movie that I watched last week by myself while my husband was out going to the kids' concert, because I have to stay home and look after the dogs. So the movie is called Passing. It's a Netflix film directed by Rebecca Hall that I wanted to watch for a long time but didn't have the time to watch. So it's based on a 1920s novel with the same title written by Nella Larsen. It depicts the story of two black women with skin color light enough to pass as white people. So Irene, the character who was married to a black doctor and lives in Harlem, ran into her childhood friend Claire one day and found out Claire was living a life as a white woman and hid her black identity and married a white man who detests black people. So the scene where Irene found out that her friend married a white man, and the husband was saying how much that he's not only dislike black people, he hates them. And it was just so revolting. And of course, you wouldn't see that kind of interaction nowadays, but obviously this is based on a 1920s novel. But it was just so confronted to her. She was very shocked, but she questioned her friend as in the reason that why you pass as a white woman. And her friend says that, you know, all the benefits I can get compared to being a black woman, it's enormous.
Yeah.
But then the movie moves on, really sets on the narratives of how both women are unhappy about their lives, how they gradually, like, for example, Claire, the woman who was passing as a white, trying to move closer back to her black community to regain some sort of, like, the sense of identity. And Irene becoming, like, increasingly jealous of her friend's presence around her family and her friend circles. So the movie was shot in black and white. So I wonder if it's, like, an intention of the director to either highlight or insinuate the skin color racial segregation in the 1920s.
So how do you tell? Can you tell very obviously the different shades of skin tone?
You can't tell the skin tone because the...
You can't?
Yeah, but you can tell from the features. You know, the African-American...
Don't they look similar? Aren't they played by the same actor?
No, they're played by different actors. So Irene and Claire, they're played by different actors.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And...
Gotcha.
I think the movie is very beautiful. It's very, very impressive that the presentation of the 1920s New York can be done so nice. And especially when you see the high social life, even without the colors, you can kind of feel like you're immersed into that surrounding. Yeah. And the music was very well done too, with a bit of jazz tone.
Yeah.
And obviously the performance of, what's the name? Tess Thompson, who played Irene, and Ruth Negger, who played Claire, was just extraordinary, I think.
They do look alike, I guess.
Yeah, they do look alike.
They're both very beautiful.
Very beautiful, yeah.
I feel like Ruth is a bit more like... Is she the one who plays Claire?
Yeah, she's the one
who... Yeah, she looks a bit more white. Yeah, because
with the blonde, you can tell with the blonde hair, even within the black and white movie. Yeah. Just certain qualities and the speech pattern, you can pick up, you can tell that it's like 1920s. It's very poignant and melancholy. And at the end, I don't want to spoil it, so I really urge everyone to go and watch it, because there's a kind of a calamity build up towards at the end of the movie. There's a tragedy. Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah. So have you ever thought about the issues surrounding passing?
Of course.
Was
this based on a book?
Yeah, it's based on a book.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we always know that skin color benefits or disadvantage, you know, individuals.
Yeah, colorism.
Life. Yeah, there's colorism. But I think nowadays there's a bit more with wealth. I think wealth might play a big part of how one is perceived in life as well.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, pass. It's easier to pass. I was going to say it's easier to pass if you have a lot of money. But what I mean is that race is not too... I feel like race and color is harder to change compared with it's more obvious and you can't really deceive people compared to like wealth. Like if I say carry everything that I wear on my body is like Hermes, you know, or Chanel. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Do you think if it's like, if even if you like put on all those luxury brands on yourself,
I'm still an Asian. I can't change. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, unfortunately, because we're Asian, we can't pass as anything other than Asian. You know, like I remember thinking when I was in my teens, I remember thinking if I dyed my hair brown, I might pass as a mixed race person, and because I always thought mixed race people were very attractive, and they are. There's something about the combination of Asian and white people's genes that make the kids like really good looking for some reason. But I remember thinking I could pass it, but like, you know, as BS, there's no way I could ever change my face without plastic surgery, without any kind of surgery to make myself look any other race. But like with say an Indian face or like a black person's face, like if you have a light shade of skin tone, like if you have a fairer skin tone, I feel like you might have a possibility to pass just because their nose shape is different. Like the facial structure of South Asians and black people, like their nose and their facial structure is more akin to white people, like more akin to an Anglo face. Whereas like with Asian features, like we have a flatter nose, like the bridge of our nose is flat. Like our face it tends to be just flat up. So we can't really pass. Yeah.
But I do know there are a lot of East Asian girls. This is like in Taiwan. They're trying to pass as a mixed person.
Oh yeah. By getting surgery on their nose.
Wearing the colored contact lens.
Are you serious?
Yeah. There are people like that. Oh, and weird. Just okay, having a wider tone of their foundation or makeup, you know.
Okay.
And then again, you know, the technique of the skills of your makeup will really determine how your face look as well, you know. Nowadays people have those crazy type of skills to make their face.
Yeah, contouring.
Look. Yeah, contouring, exactly.
I've tried it and it's just, unfortunately, I'm still left with my friggin' flat face. I've given up. I'm like, I can't.
We just come to accept our face, then it's fine.
I know. It's traumatic to watch in the mirror every morning, but, you know, I'm like, I've got like my. That. And I'm like, oh, I've got my brain going for me. I better just stick to, you know, building up my brain.
Yeah, that's more important. Speaking of books, before we have a quick break, I finished reading Joko's Smile, which is by
the
Korean prominent female writer Cho Yoon-young. It's translated by Son Yeo. It's seven short stories that were finally published after years of rejection. This is the words from the writer. So the stories focus on female friendships, mental health, struggles in communication about love. And the final two short stories were about two probationary teachers' relationship with their mother and grandmother. It was written as a first person in the viewpoint of the mother and the grandmother. Recalling their love for their daughter and granddaughter. It's one of those stories that only when you read the notes from the translator and you go back to the story, you realize the purpose of those stories. It was written for two probational teachers who were victims of a ferry accident. I don't know if you remember South Korea. It was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Close to 10 years ago that there was a ferry accident and there was like close to 100 people died. Yeah, and the government was trying to cover it up.
Really? Yeah. Shit.
And apparently there were two probation, because on that day there was a lot of school excursions.
Right.
And there were two probational teachers. Because they were still on probational terms, they never got like a proper compensation for their family. Mm-hmm. So the stories was like, when you read it, it's one of those stories that you get to a paragraph and you recognize that the writer is writing a person who is dead, but trying to remember the person as if she was alive, but only far away. It's so heart-wrenching. I cried reading the final two stories because it was so well written. I think this is one of the very similar sentiment that I think Katie Kitamura would use when writing about feelings. Yeah.
Wow, that's horrible. That's so awful. Yeah, so I'm just looking it up on Google now. It's 300 people died.
Oh my god.
How fucked up is that?
Yeah.
It's called the sinking of the MV Swell. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And it occurred on the morning of Wednesday, April 16, 2014.
Yeah, that's close to 10 years. Eight years. Yeah, 8 years ago. Yeah.
Wow, that's so shocking.
Yeah. But the way that I'm so amazed with writers who can write in such, it's not so much as in very heart-wrenching expressiveness, but with a paragraph where you approach to and you realize what the protagonist is talking about.
Right.
And you just really squeeze your heart because you realize that moment that the protagonist is talking about someone who's died, but not realizing like whatever that was built on towards the end of the story is always talking about that person is alive.
Right. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Can I read that book?
Yeah, of course.
Can you give it
tomorrow? Well, I'll see you tomorrow, and I
So what can you tell me what the can you tell me the actual story, because I only want to read that story.
Oh, it's the final two stories. The Michaela and the Secret. Yeah, those are the two final stories.
And I guess I should give you the Clean Marriage one.
Oh yes,
Life Ceremony, because I've basically finished that. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break, and when we come back we'll chat to you guys about our news items for this week. Hey guys, so we're back. I usually don't read a lot of opinion pieces, especially opinion pieces by dudes, especially dudes that look like Tom Hardy. But this is related. I mentioned Tom Hardy for a reason. About a week ago, I sent this article to Helen with a lot of thoughts, and I'm going to talk to you guys about it now on the podcast. So it's an article in The Guardian, and the title of this article is "Tom Hardy, Brad Pitt, and the Quiet Art of the Successful Celebrity Side Career." And the moment you like, basically I read it, right, and then I was like, by the end, I'll tell you what's in it. Basically it's a article about how Tom Hardy had had won a sort of very small regional competition in the UK for jiu-jitsu, and he didn't make a hoo-ha about it, and then also about Brad Pitt entering his artwork in some sort of Finnish art exhibition or something.
Yes.
And then also, again, no hoo-ha around it. And then by the end of... And it's just like the... It's sort of like the tone of it was kind of like a straight white guy sort of praising the sort of bland achievements of another straight white dude. And by the end of the article, I went up and I was like, okay, I swear on my life this article was written by a guy, and it was. And the guy, his name is Stuart Heritage, and he looks just like Tom Hardy. Like, literally, his face just, he looks just like Tom Hardy. And the reason why I was bothered by this article was that towards the end, it kind of made fun of female celebrities who, like, have had things outside of their acting career. So, like, they, you know, Selena Gomez, I can, you know, name off a billion, like Jessica Alba, Gwyneth Paltrow, all these celebrities who have managed to, like, create another life for themselves, making money.
Miranda Kerr, skincare.
Yeah, Miranda Kerr. Most of the women create companies based on their looks, I guess, in, like, they promote some sort of skin aesthetic wellness
appearance.
Aesthetically prone. It's always based, their commerce comes from like looking better, right?
Yeah.
And so like this journalist was kind of like dissing people who do that, and then kind of praising how Tom Hardy and Brad Pitt, I don't remember what his line was in the article, but it was like, oh, this is the real way that real artists do it. They do it humbly and quietly and without telling anyone about it, you know? And I was like...
Well, he's writing an article about it. How would anyone not know about it? It's just kind of hypocrite of him saying
that. Well, he's praising something that's... Yeah, but...
No, everyone knows.
But yeah. But like, I mean, mind you, he doesn't only attack women. He also attacks, like, I think there was another... male Jim Broadbent, he also kind of criticized, apparently taking, like, he says, Jim Broadbent possibly regrets his decision to take his hobby public in 2015.
What do you do?
It says this is because his hobby involves crudely carving life-size human beings out of wood, then dressing them and putting them in wigs.
Okay, so he's making, like, mannequins.
Yeah, I guess. But, like, I guess I just had a little... I had a little problem with the tone of this article because it wasn't overtly sexist, but it kind of had sexist undertones in that he... It was an article...
It's judging on people's choices of what they do.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking... Yeah. This guy obviously doesn't know what it means to be a woman. Because if you're a woman and you bank on your ability to, like, make money based on your looks, I mean, who can blame anyone else for doing that, you know? Yeah, like,
because that's how the society is constructed.
Yeah, like, don't blame Gwyneth Paltrow just because she's managed to, you know, find a niche to, like, exploit the... you know, beauty anxieties. Yeah, for, like, millions of people, women around the world. Like I think she's, like, really smart. Like, I don't agree with a lot of these, like, beauty products. Obviously, I don't buy them myself because I can't afford it. Well, I choose not to because... Yeah, vagina crystals or whatever. But, like, it was, like, very subtly sexist, in my opinion, because it criticized the decisions that women made based on... just, like, the choices that they have for them, you know?
Yeah,
and, like, and it's, like, Tom Hardy, it's not like Tom Hardy's going to come out and, you know, like, I don't like it when, like, men are praised for everything that they do, including what they don't do. So just because, like, Tom Hardy decided not to tweet about or, like, put a photo of himself winning the tournament up on Instagram, it's like, ooh, let's applaud him because of his humbleness. Mm. It's like...
I think it's like almost like it's a marketing strategy for Tom Hardy.
Yeah, because it's a like strategy. No matter what he does, he's going to be praised.
Yes,
That's what I had the problem with, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a strategy for those male celebrities who doesn't talk about it. Eventually, someone will be talking about it. They don't need to talk about it themselves.
You know? And it's almost like a bit of a flex because like Tom Hardy knows that his win will be picked up. You know what I mean? Yeah. He didn't need to broadcast it because he's so famous that he knew that someone in the world was going to pick it up.
Yes.
It's kind of almost like, I know you haven't seen the series Curb Your Enthusiasm, but it's like my partner, it's one of my partner's favorite and, you know, a lot of my favorite people love it. Billy is one of Billy's favorite shows. And like I'm watching it through with my partner at the moment. And I think it was in season 4 or 5 where like one of the episodes is... Ted Danson and Larry David, they decide to donate to a museum somewhere in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And then Larry David is very proud that he has a wall named after him. And then, like, Ted Danson has actually decided to not put his name on the wall and instead use the word anonymous. Uh-huh. So he's, like, and then people are praising him because... He's like, I'm not so egotistical that I need my name on it. But however, he has told people. He has told a few people, and so it spreads, you know. Uh-huh. And so Larry's like, well, if you wanted to be anonymous, you should have just been 100% anonymous. You shouldn't have told people. It's like masturbating to your own apparent humility.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you were really humble, you wouldn't have told anyone at all. But because he told someone, like just one person, it means like.
He still cares. He wants people to know.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah,
reminds me of that debacle about the writers. Do you remember last year we were talking about it about a writer who wrote about pup like trying to tell everyone in her own group about how she donated the kidney, and then another writer picked up.
Yes.
Oh my god, that was such a messy chaos.
Oh, and it was between an Asian writer or a mixed race writer and a white woman. What was this? It was like the art problem. The bad art monster or something. Yeah, it was the art monster. It was
such a big thing last year.
Oh my god, I cannot believe you brought that up, Helen, because I have to say that was literally one of those things that like come like storms and then completely just everyone forgets about it the next day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I literally have forgotten the name of the woman. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of both writers, but I remember the incident. It was so big in our industry in US.
Yeah, it is, and I have to say, a lot of people, it's like very disingenuous when you present yourself as someone who doesn't care about, you know, care about being praised for something you did. And yet you still manage to disclose it to someone. Meaning there is some part of you that wanted to be praised for it. You know what I mean?
I wonder if that's like the human traits. Like it needs to be known. You know, it's almost like what we do on social media. Like there's a bit of us, even a tiny bit, that we're trying to let other people know that we're doing something worthy in the life, or we're trying to show off.
Yeah. Or you downplay it. Yeah. You know, like I feel like young people these days, like, it's this thing that I often think about and I really hate. It's when people kind of pretend that they're not ambitious. Mm. I hate that so much. Like, I actually really like people who just come out and say, you know, I want to rule the world. I want to win 1 million, you know, gold medals. Like, I prefer people who are, like, very unapologetic and genuine and just transparent about their ambitions and goals. Like, I hate it when people are like, they win a huge award and they're like, oh, I never expected this to happen to me. I didn't really try. I just like, I just did it. And, you know, look where I am at the top of the world. It's like, it's so disingenuous and I hate it. And I think it's a very generational thing. Mm. And like, I just, it kind of reminds me when I was in high school, there was a guy who hadn't come out as gay. He was an Asian dude who was very smart. And I remember like one time we were in year 12, and we were all like sitting around in this like group situation, and we all had to, you know, we were saying what we would like to do with our lives. And he said that everyone kind of had basic ambitions, like I want to go to uni to study something or whatever, travel to Europe or whatever. And this guy comes out and says, I'm going to cure cancer. And just like the reaction from everyone around the room was just like, you're so embarrassing. Everyone was kind of cringed in themselves for him.
Yeah.
And I was just like, who cares? Like, good for you. Like, I like people who are kind of very unapologetic about their big ambitions.
That means that he's confident enough as well. That's something that, especially coming from an Asian person, that's very rare, I think.
Yeah.
Because usually we'll be taught to be humble, like, oh, don't make it so big, like, about yourself and things like that.
That's amazing. I hate it when you pretend that you haven't worked hard for something.
And what happened to that friend?
I don't know.
He's working in the research of some big medical project.
I don't know.
Yeah. He's possibly doing that now. Yeah. We don't know. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, what's your piece of news item that you want to rant about this week?
Oh, I don't have any news items that I want to rant about this week. I think that's pretty much enough for us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess,
white
yeah, man final thoughts.
Another white
yeah.
man.
Yeah. And, like, just
patting themselves on the back. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, it just, I would love for listeners to read the article by Stuart Heritage.
Let us know what you think.
Yeah, and let us know what you think, because I'm curious. I'm very curious.
Okay, so that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple, and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. So that's it from us this week, and we'll chat to you next time.
Stay safe.
Bye.